Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm rebroadcasting a show I did way back in February of 2009. At the beginning of the show, I'm talking about brain chemistry, how our brains learn to connect certain situations with certain responses. And once they've learned that a particular situation requires a particular response, they drop the chemical that lets us know the response that's necessary every time that situation occurs. Of course, we learn this very young. And later in life, these responses may be the opposite of what we want. So, from the ridiculous to the sublime, I'm going to play the first half of an interview I did with Dickie Smothers. I don't need to say anything more about this. It's beyond adorable. So, hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
and welcome to The Lynn Show, coming to you over the Radio Ear Network. You probably certainly know that, and you probably certainly also know what time it is wherever it is you are. It's 1 o'clock here in beautiful Sarasota, Florida, which is where I am lucky enough to live these days. And as I said, this is The Lynn Show. What you're going to hear, if you listen to The Lynn Show, is the various things that I know about, care about, and am interested in. And I hope that they are things that you also care about and are interested in. So some of what you hear on these shows will come from my book called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. And other information that I've learned over the years from my psychotherapy practice and my consulting career. Last week, I talked about the myths that we believe about change and how believing things that are not true get in our way and influence us. Today, I want to talk about brain chemistry. We rarely think about the impact that what's going on in our brain has on what we are able to do and what we are not able to do. But in fact, our brain, the firing of the neurons in our brain and the chemicals that it drops into our bloodstream is profoundly affecting how we act, what we can do, what we think we can do, what we think we're unable to do. We are, as a species, creatures of habit. We don't really like change. I know it's popular these days to talk about loving change and embracing change, but as a species, we really don't want to. We want to do what I like to call putting as much as we can in the I don't have to think about it box. There is so much that we have to process every day, so many complications, that everything that we can put in the I don't have to think about it box simplifies our life. And I don't have to tell you that every day, every week, every month, our life becomes more and more complicated. More and more things have to be thought about, figured out, evaluated, planned, learned. We're all confronted more and more and more with new things that we have to learn to do. And the more things we don't have to pay attention to, the easier our life is. And so we put as many things as we can in the I don't have to think about it box. It's spontaneous. It's autopilot. And our brain helps us with that. I think about the brain as the world's most labor-saving device. It learns so many things for us, and then we don't have to think about it. So, for example, if you're driving along the road and the light at the stoplight turns red, you don't have to think about whether red means stop or go. Long before you have processed the question, your foot's on the brake. Your brain has associated red, light, stop, and you stop. It doesn't come in for calculation, evaluation, analyzation. It's spontaneous. Our life is filled with these things. Things that we do over and over and over again that we don't have to think about. Many years ago, I had a psychotherapy client, who worked for one of the intelligence services. And he told me that if you ever want to find somebody, all you ever have to do is follow them for one day. If you follow somebody for one day, the chances are you will always know where they're going to be, because we're creatures of habit. So we wake up at the same time, pretty much. We have our coffee in the same cup. We sit in the same chair. We drive to work along the same route. We take lunch at the same time. We generally even eat in the same restaurant. We may even eat the same thing for lunch every day with the same people. We go to the same coffee shop on the way home. We stop at the same grocery store. We're programmed, really. Because if we had to stop and ask ourselves every day, do I want to drink out of this coffee cup or that one? Do I want to eat in this restaurant or that one? Do I want to have this meal or that one? We wouldn't be able to get out of bed. There are so many decisions to make. And when we want to break one of these habits, we can feel the resistance inside of us. I had this experience. I actually gave this experience to myself to test it. I live near the beach, and I drive to the beach, and I park almost always in the same parking space if it's available. And then when I step onto the beach, I have the choice of turning right or turning left to walk. On my particular beach, there's not a lot of beach left to the right. It runs out. So I turn to the left and I walk. I can walk for a very long time. And that's how I do it. I get on the beach, turn to the left, and I walk. I went to a convention in another beach town, and on some time off, I went to walk on the beach. And I thought to myself, well, I'll test this. Instead of making the left turn on the beach, I'll make the right turn on the beach. I did. But I could feel my body saying, this is wrong. We're not supposed to be turning right. We're supposed to be turning left. When our feet are on the sand, we're supposed to be turning left. Well, obviously, I could make my body turn right, and for the days that I was at the convention, I turned right. And then when I got back to my home beach, I wanted to turn left, and I did. But I promise you, I could feel the resistance in my body. We are programmed to learn as many things as possible and not to have to think about them. And that, as I have been trying to say, works to our advantage. It makes it possible for us to get through our day doing the kinds of routine things that don't require thought and reevaluation and alteration. But, as you can perhaps see, when our brain has learned something wrong or something that was right at one time but now needs to be changed, there is resistance from inside of us. This is where the brain chemistry comes into play. Our brain, or more specifically the neurons which fire in our brain, tell us what to feel. A neuron fires and drops a chemical in our bloodstream, and that chemical makes us feel something. It makes us feel happy or sad, frightened, angry, anxious, excited, etc. When the chemical enters our bloodstream, we feel whatever it's telling us to feel, and then we make decisions about what's going on in our world based on what we're feeling. For example, if your brain drops the fear chemical into your bloodstream, you're likely to feel scared. And when you're scared, you assume you must be in danger. You may not be in danger, but if you're frightened, you assume there must be danger, and then you behave as though it were true. Unfortunately, sometimes our brain makes mistakes and drops chemicals which are not appropriate to the situation into our bloodstream. And then we make decisions which are not appropriate to the situation. For example, if you were bitten by a dog when you were a child, it is likely that the fear and pain that you experienced at that time comes back whenever you see dogs later in life. It may be translated into a sort of mild dislike or an avoidance, or you may just say, I'm somebody who doesn't really like dogs. Or you might actually be frightened when you see dogs. Even though the chances are good, most of these dogs are not dangerous to you. The chemical that's gotten dropped into your bloodstream and tells you that you're frightened also tells you that these dogs are dangerous, and you behave accordingly. This is often what's happening when we want to do something and our brain tells us we should not be doing it. It does this by dropping a chemical into our bloodstream which makes us sad or scared or resentful, or somehow makes the thing we want to do appear to be scary or threatening or just ugly. So it was with Christine. She wanted to ask for a raise at work. She deserved it. She knew she deserved it. Everyone knew she deserved it. But her boss was stonewalling her. All she had to do was ask. But every time she thought of asking, her throat closed and her stomach felt like she'd just been on a particularly nauseating carnival ride. Why was her brain dropping these chemicals into her bloodstream? Why did it want to stop her from getting the raise she worked for and deserved? It didn't seem to make sense, and it really worried and upset Christine. Eventually, in therapy, we discovered the reason. Christine's mother was a loud and bossy woman who was always afraid that Christine was going to embarrass her. Christine had one very painful memory that occurred when she was 5 or 6. She and her mom had gone to a little friend's holiday party. There were presents for all the children. The children drew numbers to see who would pick first, and Christine got number 1. She was so excited. She ran immediately for the biggest present and grabbed it. Her mother yelled, "You put that back immediately! You don't just grab for the biggest present!" Christine dropped the present and took something small. This was not the only time in her life that Christine's mother told her or showed her that it was bad or ugly to ask for what you wanted. And Christine's brain learned the lesson. If you ask for what you want, you will be humiliated. And so even though she clearly deserved as well as wanted her raise, the chemical that dropped into her bloodstream whenever she thought of making it stopped her. Obviously, in this case, Christine's brain learned a lesson which was incorrect to the current situation. And in this way, we're not so very different from animals. Apparently, if you tie a baby elephant to a tree, then it learns that it's stuck. When the elephant grows up and is big and strong and could tear down pretty much any tree, if you tie it by a string to a branch, it won't try and get away. When you have a powerful experience, an intense experience, or you have the same experience time and time again, the brain learns to associate that experience with the emotion that has been generated by it. They say that when neurons fire together, they wire together. So if in the future you have an experience that is similar to, resembles to, or very close to the experience you had when you were young, the brain will fire the appropriate chemical and drop it into your bloodstream, even if, as in Christine's case, or in the case of the poor elephant, the lesson it learned is incorrect to the current situation. Alan's experience is an example of this. Alan's mother was an alcoholic and a rageaholic. She terrorized her young son. He lived in fear of her depression and her rage. He was vigilant, ever watchful, to see what Mommy wanted or needed. Inevitably, he failed her and was punished. Then Alan grew up, but his relationship with his mother never changed. With a word or a look, she could get him to do anything she wanted, and she took full advantage of the power she had over him. Now, although grown and married, his mother routinely calls him and asks him to do menial things which she could clearly do for herself. And even though he doesn't want to do these things, he feels compelled to comply. He spends too much time jumping to her requests, and he sacrifices his time and his relationship. He cannot resist her. He wants to say no. He feels an overwhelming sense of guilt, under which is a fear he doesn't always acknowledge, and so he rushes to do whatever she wants. Finally, he became able to resist the impulse to call and check on her, to see if she needed anything, to be, as he says, the good son. But after a certain period of time, the memory of her sad face and her betrayed-sounding voice would occur to him, and that memory would generate a powerful sense of guilt. She didn't even have to be there doing it. He could manufacture her in his brain and then react as though she had called and laid that guilt on him. The brain, unfortunately, can't tell the difference between what is actually happening and what is remembered. So when Alan remembers his mother's sad face and the depressed voice, the part of him that experienced her abuse knows that a terrifying punishment is about to occur, and he reacts appropriately. Alan doesn't know why he can't resist her outrageous requests. He's angry at her, and he's angry at himself, but he can't stop. Now, as a married man who's contemplating having a family of his own, he wants to break that chain that bonds him to his mother. But the feelings are so strong, and the apprehension that something terrible will happen if he defies her is so intense that at 40, he's begun to dread the phone ringing for fear it will be his mother and she will wield this power over him. Like most of us, Alan has forgotten or buried the abuse that set the neural firing in his childhood. And so this behavior makes no sense to him. He berates himself as a fool and a coward. So, are there things in your life that you want to do very, very badly but are unable to do, no matter how much you promise yourself that you will? Or maybe there are things that you continue to do, like Alan, that you really wish you could stop doing, but somehow you simply can't? Perhaps a neuron fired in your childhood, and you are at the mercy of the chemical dropping into your bloodstream. Knowing this, knowing that that's what's going on, can help a lot. It doesn't necessarily change behavior, and I will talk more and more about how you do that, how you change brain chemistry, no easy thing. But knowing that that's what's going on can make you feel much, much better about it. At least then, you're not yelling at yourself, saying, I shouldn't be doing this. You're understanding the powerful motivation for this behavior that you would perhaps prefer not to have. So, okay, enough about brain chemistry for the moment. Now to a dramatically lighter subject. As promised, I am going to play the first half of my interview with the unbelievably delightful Dickie Smothers. And after I play the interview, I'm going to play a bit that came out of the Smothers Brothers show. Dickie talks about this bit in this part of the interview. It's the one where he is trying to tell Tommy that there are no pumas in the United States. And I was lucky enough to find this bit on YouTube, so I'm going to play it after the interview. And I need to preface what happens at the beginning of this interview. I had said to Dickie that everybody knows who he is, and so he is correcting me about that. And here, the very not-so-bozo on the bus, Dickie Smothers.
So I'm here with Dickie Smothers.
By the way, I'm corrected. Not everybody knows me, but I am Dick Smothers, and I am what I am. I'm like Popeye.
Yes.
I am what I am.
You think everybody doesn't know you?
Oh, of course. I hope not. Because there's a lot of bill collectors that are trying to hunt me down.
But whether he says so or not, I think there's probably nobody listening who doesn't know.
But people know about me, don't know about me. They don't know anything about me. Well, I don't think we know anything about an entertainer. All we see is that part that's out there. And nor should you want to know. It's like, if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me.
Yeah, you and Groucho Marx, is that? I wouldn't belong to a club that would want to have me?
Yeah, I remember, that's true, that's the Groucho. There's a Groucho club in London for people that didn't get in the better clubs.
Yeah, the clubs.
Yeah. Friends of mine joined. I got off the track there.
Well, there's something I want to ask you, actually.
Yeah.
The emphasis that I have for these interviews has to do with how people discover the art that they then gave their life to. So
all different ways.
Well, what I want to know is yours. Yeah. What do you remember how this started for you?
Yeah.
And did it start for you and Tommy, or did it start for you separately? Or
well, it started as brothers. I mean, that's the thing. You know, it's hard to explain being family.
I mean, did you guys cut
versus
off when you were
meeting
kids
in school and
music
class and let's start a group?
Yeah, because you guys were always together.
Yeah, we weren't Andy Hardy and Judy Garland.
Yeah.
So the start is so vague. And show business to me is nothing any different than most businesses. You got to be incredibly lucky, a certain amount of talent, timing. It's just so many things
that you can't
take credit for. So it's just how deep do you want to get into what got you there? How did I become a straight man to a relatively stumbling, lovable, bumbling, dyslexic brother and have a show at a time in history that wasn't just entertainment, but it was politically relevant and it was important to an awful lot of people? And did you start out that way? No, it's just the way the road took us.
And how did you start out? Did you have aspirations that were going to go somewhere else?
No. That's what's still so disappointing, to people. There was no epiphany, this thing in my life said, oh, gosh, I want to get in show business. I wanted to be a civilian, just a regular person. When I dropped out of school with the show business, I was thinking towards elementary education. My Uncle Dick was a teacher. That's my mother's younger brother. And a principal and administrator, and they thought I'd take after him. His name was Richard Remick, and my name was Richard Remick Smothers. He was left-handed, I was left-handed. He was born November, I was born November, both Scorpios. Okay, it's written.
it's written.
You will follow Uncle Dick.
Right.
And fortunately, because I'm Uncle Dick, I got my show business name. He was Big Dick, and I was Little Dickie Smothers.
God.
It's a little dicky Smothers. And they say, hey, Dick. And they say, what, what? And they said, no, big dick. No, little dick. You know, so that's how you differentiate.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And they didn't call one of us Richard. And they could have done that very easily. Mm-hmm. But I'm a little dicky Smothers. So. I think it was Tommy's drive to want to do the artistic thing, and he didn't think it was artistic. He wanted to be funny at one time, but he didn't know it was called a comedian. He thought it was monologuous. And he was a big fan of George Gobel, who was a big TV star in the early 50s. Lonesome George. Mm-hmm. He was a crew cut, short little guy. I'll be a dirty bird. Everybody in America was saying, well, I'll be a dirty bird. It's better than the F words we're using today, mm-hmm. by far. I'll be a dirty bird. Mm-hmm. And he played a big F hole guitar, and he sang a little bit, and he was country. A little bit like Tennessee Ernie Ford, I was a great fan of his. Mm-hmm. I liked the folksy stuff. And they weren't aggressive. They were just nice people you'd invite to dinner.
Yeah.
Of course, George could put away about 2 quarts of vodka, and I think it was whiskey he liked. He and Tommy once killed a whole bottle in New York to L.A., and I don't know if any of your listeners are old enough to remember, one of the things George used to say in the shows, boy, Alice is really going to give it to me this time. You know, when he knew he was in trouble, mm-hmm. you know, well, as Tommy helped him off the airplane, he says, Alice is really going to give it to me. So when Tommy saw Alice, this lady scowling at George, she said, George, you're really going to get it this time. It was a comedy bit. But those guys had drank their 2 drinks that were supposed to get before the plane took off. And so they killed the bottle on the way. But that was his hero. You do get drunk with your hero. Willie Nelson, I got to have a shooter of tequila with Willie, and Tommy smoked a joint with him in the bus. So that was an honor. And then Willie went on and did the Dolly Parton. We were in Dolly Parton parking lot. This was years and years ago. And so, you know, to do something with someone you honor. So anyway, I'm not answering your question, but you could start it again.
I'll just keep asking. I love where you're going. It doesn't matter.
I have no idea where I'm going.
And I won't forget where I was. So, no. So we have you in school.
You sure this thing's working okay? No, Kate, don't stop.
No, I'm not going to stop it because it is.
The clock is turning. Yeah, I see it. Okay. Yeah. This is a highly mechanized studio, I want to say. I won't go into it. It's top secret, so I won't let anybody know.
Where it is.
We are. Yeah, we're somewhere in America. South, east
America.
They all
know. Yeah. Because they all know where I am.
But you're traveling on the road this time.
Oh, that's right. I
forgot that. So you're not where you normally
are. I'm not where I normally are.
Yeah, see how I... Now they don't know.
No, they don't know.
So anyway, how do a couple kids...
Yeah.
I think...
Wait a minute. Wait. So we have Tommy, who's in love with George Gobel and wants to be a monologuist. Is he practicing with you? I mean, is he you?
No.
You're not involved in this at all. You're going to go to school and be a teacher.
Yeah, I wasn't involved in that at all. What we did together growing up was Tommy produced a couple shows, one in the 40s, about 1946. He produced a March of Dimes neighborhood gymnastics show featuring Toby, the amazing tricked mongrel black little dog, who did not one trick. He did not like crowds. We had the tricks down, but that was just the 2 of us. Now there was this crowd of neighborhood kids. And by the way, a dollar went a long way in those days.
Mm-hmm.
A penny went a long way. You bought things for a penny at the store. And we raised over $10.
Wow.
So it was quite a success. In gymnastics, we did pyramids and tumbling. Just silly things.
Just the 2 of you?
No. All the neighborhood kids. Tommy enlisted all the neighborhood kids to get in this gymnastics. So he was a producer.
I was just going to say,
it's his
from
first
the beginning.
Yeah.
Right. How old were you then?
I was probably only in about second grade, third grade.
Oh, my God. And Tommy was what? Yeah,
fifth grade, probably.
Yeah, right.
Or maybe even younger than that. I think it's maybe even younger. And Mom he had interest in music, and Mom bought him a guitar, a Martin guitar, a little blonde finish, small six-string guitar. And Barney, a friend of hers, had an F-hole guitar. F-holes were the kind they played in orchestras. I don't know how they heard them in the big orchestras, big bands, but there's always a guitar guy strumming
away.
And a guy with an upright bass, and they didn't mic them. So anyway, so Tommy took a few lessons, and then he got a guitar book. And that's one of the great instruments. If anybody wants to learn an instrument, you could sit by yourself, isolate, you know, fill the house with liquor or whatever you prefer, just and strings and picks right. and play your life away.
Right. Yeah, well, but he was, I mean, what are we talking about here now? He was 6th grade, 7th grade, 8th grade?
No, he was younger than that. He was 10 years old.
Maybe. 10 years old.
Yeah, maybe 10 years old, maybe less. And he thought he invented a harmonica holder. He took wire coat hangers and rubber bands. He didn't know they made harmonica holders. He didn't know anything of that stuff. And so he would play it on my whoo, you know, trump.
I'm sorry you can't see him doing this.
but eventually, you know, you do get B.B. King. You can't say, how did you learn to B.B. King? How did you learn to play like that? What was your teacher? He says, life.
Yeah, right.
Or he would hear a few people. Willie Nelson plays a guitar. I'm sure he knows fundamentally how to do guitar, but he made it so unique. You hear two strums, you know, that's Willie. Mm-hmm. And B.B. King. And so Tommy got that. And my theatrical aspect was being in little school plays and choir. I was always a good tenor. I wasn't a tenor. I was actually a bass in fifth and sixth grade. I was held back a year, so my voice changed. And I was a bass. And then the only reason I became a tenor was in high school, they needed a tenor in the elite madrigal. Uh-huh. Very small choir. I said, well, I'll be a tenor if you want me to.
Yeah, right.
Tommy once, and he produced Hair in L.A. with Michael Butler. Brought it to, and we had a big Age of Aquarius party after the opening at this big nightclub. And some gal came up to Tom, and she was really sexy and drinking a party. Tommy says, are you an Aquarius? She says, no, but I'll be one if you want me to. So I'll be a tenor. So I've been a fake tenor for all these years. And maybe, I don't know how my voice still is. It's sort of rough when I talk now, but it still holds together. So I became a tenor. So I faked everything, actually. But I was always a good singer, and I'd be the tenor in Tommy's singing groups. He'd put the choirs. The choir, we did it. Then we did the singing groups of the day. You always copied whatever's
what was going on.
The four aces, the four preps, or whatever. And Tommy would end up playing in little combos with guys that had piano, drums, and guitar. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to be a band leader, you know. Have a combo, you know, those little things, as the steps along the way. So he was there and always the driving force to put together a group. And he wasn't as good a singer as I was as quick. And so when our biggest fights, I would rehearse and I'd be tired of rehearsing because I got it already. He says, no, this is for me. So this went on for maybe 40 years. So we had to have counseling.
Did you read Jerry Lewis' book about me and Dean?
No, but I heard it's pretty good.
It's wonderful. And at some point, when he's talking about the breakup, he said, you know, we needed couple counseling, but they just didn't have it then.
Yeah, well, that's interesting because they did have it now. So about 15 years ago, they came up to Tommy's vineyard, and the lady I was with, my future ex-wife, I was with her, and Tommy's future ex-wife, and we had about 3 days of couples counseling, and it was to break up without acrimony, without anger, or to bring you up to higher levels of creativity and understanding.
Yeah.
And that's what happened with us. We didn't start making our own story about what that person was meant when they said criticized,
right.
Things like that. So anyway, so it helped us, and it's a shame because I think Dean and Jerry could have developed much more than they did.
Yeah.
And they were such a huge hit. Dean was the funny talent. And Jerry makes me very uncomfortable, the egomania of the guy.
Well, in the book, he gives all this credit to Dean.
He didn't when they were working together.
No, but that's part of the problem.
My brother would, if he wrote a book, he'd give me all the credit, but living is a living hell. Stanley, Stan Laurel used to beat up emotionally Oliver Hardy, the big fat guy.
Really?
Stanley was the womanizer. You know, he loved the chicks. He loved the creative thing. And the other guy liked to eat, obviously, and play golf. And
right.
He was a marvelous performer. But he wasn't up to the obsessiveness of Stan, who was the creator. And he could not have created that greatness without this man.
So are you
and
saying...
same with Jerry.
Couldn't yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
Same
are you saying
Tommy.
The same with Tommy?
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
I'm absolutely the perfect straight man for him. And every great team has the perfect straight man, or they wouldn't be great. Now we're into comedy teams. If you take Bud Abbott out of Lou Costello in about 5 minutes, it'd drive you crazy. Hyperactive, fat little guy screaming all the time. He needed this guy that you didn't like.
Right.
And he wasn't, and Abbott was the most giving straight man I've ever seen. Dean had a, you know, with double Jerry and get the girls and did the singing. They had a softness to him too, a romanticism, but not Abbott. Abbott was always trying to take advantage of that little guy. Thank God he found this man. I've never seen it written that where he said, without Abbott, it wouldn't happen. You take more contemporary Ronan Martin from Laugh-In. The power in that group was Dan, the straight man. That's unusual. He was a stronger personality. He was smooth. He was smart. Yes. He's a very intellectual guy. He was quite close with John D. McDonald, a local resident here.
Really?
Yeah. They have a book out that was put out after they both died called Friendship, Their Letters. They were pen pals during the time that Laugh-In was being conceived, and they had not met. They just somehow connected on letters, and they both shared their lives back and forth. And after they both died, it was put out. And you see what kind of man that Dan was. I knew Dan a bit. And he was a stronger than Dick. Dick was the perfect foil for him. See, it's still a matching.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like basketball. Five All-Stars will lose.
Yeah.
You only need one or two. So it's a teaming of things. And you could say, with those other people, they got together later in life.
Yes.
And they were...
They found each other.
They found whatever. And they made it happen. Ours was actually forming from the time we were born.
Right. How many years between you?
Two.
Two.
Not quite two. But so basically you got to say, you know, that. And then you get all the things that are out of your control that put you in this chair today.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't have chosen those things. You've gone through a lot of pain in your life. We all have. And there's not one person living this many years who can't match you pain for pain. So your pity party is appreciated, noted, and get on with it.
And get on with it, right.
And we all have been there.
Right.
And generally, it's our own doing. A lot of it is our own doing. It took my personal growth and my failed marriages, it took me about 15 years to say, I'm 100% responsible. Maybe they would have, the second one would end in divorce, but I was responsible for what happened there. So a lot of things we're not responsible for in our life.
Also happen.
Yeah, so that it's like multi-dimensional things, like playing checkers or chess in 10 dimensions.
Yes.
You're only
moving,
involved in this and that. You're
true.
Moving your piece, and then there's all this world going around you. Oprah says she's incredibly lucky. Obviously, it's a trillion to one. She'd be one of the most important women in the world. But anyway, those outside forces, and now we get back to Tommy and I,
mm-hmm.
Not that we're special. We're not special. We're bozos, just like anybody else. He's stumbling through life trying to, like that new Robert De Niro movie where he plays a movie producer. He's a powerful, pretty producer, but he's got all the stuff around him that's dragging him down. He's just trying to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a mistress. He's got an ex-wife. He's got this. He's got this director who did this terrible ending on a movie. The studio head wants it to be in Cannes, but the dog doesn't get shot at the end of the movie like this drug-induced director wants. Now you change it or you're out of here. And he's just Robert De Niro. You're so empathetic. And there's all this stuff around him, and he is his talent.
Right.
Now, things in his life could have been different. The guy could have been off the drugs in rehab and said, I love the dog ending. We're going to make it fuzzy. It could have been there. It could have been a
right,
hit.
Right,
this
right,
could
right,
have
right,
been
right,
this
right.
and that and this. And out of his control.
Right.
And at the end of the movie, the plane leaves without him.
Oh, no.
Yeah, well, like the bus leaves without you. You're standing there and you're looking around. And says,
how did this
what
happened? Right.
And that's sort of the title of the movie. It's sort of like, just what happened?
What the hell happened?
What the hell happened? And sometimes just what the hell happened is...
It's good.
It's good. You go bowling, you hit a garbage ball, it's down in the gutter, and all of a sudden...
It pops up.
It pops up because someone threw a beer can down there or something, and you got a strike and you win the match. I don't know. But anyway, so Tommy and I's thing, we were just the right amount of... a talent, age, wired, or defects, personal defects. And then you have to throw in World War II, my dad getting killed in the war, mom becoming an alcoholic, marrying many times, lived with grandparents, uncles, this and that, extended family, God bless them, they were there. And then mom struggling, and mom liked you best was one of the things we're noted for.
Yeah.
But it wasn't really that in real life. It was like Aunt Mom, let's take care of Mom. And Tommy was the leader on that, being the eldest. And finally, she did get, after many times, some recovery. But how much does all of that have with the way Tommy filters his relationship with women today. We survived childhood in many ways. Now, Tommy and I, we had that injured stuff, but it's not unusual. We were born in the late 30s. I'm 70, and Tommy's 72, he's born 37, 38. And so many people lost their sons and daughters and fathers and mothers in the war. Not just as combatants and as in the Holocaust and Russia. I mean, it was 100 million people maybe got killed during that conflagration or that. It's got to be some astronomical. So we're not unusual, and there's no pity party here. I'm just bringing that up. Those are the little things that deflected a straight, normal existence like Andy Hardy had to whatever we had.
You know, I'm wondering, is it also a consequence of this, of the circumstances of your life that you got moved around a lot, you had to take care of Mom, but you and Tommy were always together.
We were the consistent.
You were the consistent pieces,
just
right?
Like your good friends.
Right.
It doesn't matter how many lovers you have.
Right.
If it's a good friend from...
It's a good friend.
Forever.
Right. And so that's a bond that really is...
I don't think our bond would be shattered. I don't think it could be. Now, it doesn't mean it's not dysfunctional. It can be dysfunctional. But we've worked through that. And some things Tommy has... The talent that would come so easily for him. I'm a straight man because he said, Dick, you're a very talented straight man, but the thing is so many have your talent, so few have mine. And it's absolutely first of all, it's a thing a sibling would say to another one. You know, you're good, but I'm better. I never had that talent, so I could leave a room without a laugh. Now, but it's a funny thing with being a straight man. You have to listen all the time if it's believable. Because just a change in a response. Tommy and I never wrote a show down. So even though our shows are similar, they sort of morph slowly change like we do over the years. You see yourself every day in the mirror and you say, I haven't changed at all. But someone doesn't see you for quite a while. You have. And so have you inside. And our show moves around. And if we don't pay attention, I can't give a proper response or
right.
Whatever.
And anyway, it shows if you're not paying attention.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's where people make a mistake, an early mistake. And it's a learning mistake. It may be necessary. When they want to be a comedy team, they get it all down. And it sounds written and trite and stiff.
And it is.
It is. But most comedians bomb miserably for quite a while.
But the other thing about you and Tommy, well, I mean, you've been essentially doing this all your lives. You know?
50 years, you know.
Yeah, no, but I mean, you know, from childhood, the interactions between you would have been similar,
yeah, but
right?
But they were just sibling reactions.
Yeah, right, exactly, but...
No one could have come in and said, hey, you should be a comedy team. No one ever said that, because I wasn't never this role. See, a lot of people are confused, why am I the younger brother when I'm the one that's trying to hold Tommy accountable? And that's the structure of our show, if you want to, in a nutshell, hold Tommy accountable for his lies,
right.
Omissions, and exaggerations. And it was an easy step to hold the government, or political
things, or
society. So all we did was change the focus and what we talked about. It's the same thing. We all want, I think anywhere in the world, you want people accountable. And truth.
Yeah,
truth is the biggest thing. And truth, we got to understand, there's only certain truths that don't change. The rest of the truths are what you believe. And they change, and as knowledge changes. So, but as we see it, and with Tommy, if he exaggerates or omits something, and like a child, that's how we started a very childlike belief. And you get people pumas in the crevices, and you know, and the vat of chocolate, and he's got all these traitors and tractors. And I said, no, traitors and trappers. No, trailers and tractors. No, our forefathers were traitors. They traded things and they weren't tractors. They trapped animals. And he said, they carried the goods through the vast river system. I said, that's true. And he says, and he turns his guitar flat, so it's like a table in front of him. Like this. This is a flat boat. See, his voice would get real high. He made this stuff up. Look at that. See, our forefathers had these vast flatboats with these big flatboats, and he's rubbing his hands on the back of the guitar, and the neck is over here to his left, and he says, and I'm the front of these boats had these big rudders, and they would carry these goods. I said, wait a minute, they didn't have big rudders. He said, they didn't have big rudders. How do they steer the boats with the big rudders? Well, rudders aren't on the front of the boats, they're on the back of the boats. No, these were on the front. They don't have rudders on the front of the boat. I'd get him totally off the rest of his lies.
Right.
And then he would do, he said, okay, well, no, maybe there was on the, maybe that was the back of the boat. Or then he said they had these big poles and they carried essential goods, like things that they needed. And he would just elaborate on all this stuff that wasn't true.
Right.
And I would call him, that's not a rudder, they didn't do this, there were no Pumas in America. Of course, I would correct him incorrectly half the time. Because that's what you do to someone who doesn't know.
No, that's right, because it doesn't matter
it
what
doesn't
you
matter.
Say.
Because we did have Pumas in America, but then I get him to admit we didn't. And then he said, they still have Pumas, but they didn't look like Pumas. I said, what do you mean? He said, they look like rocks. They were rocks? Yeah, there was dangers in the crevices. Because there's crevices you built these railroads over, and the railroad workers go down and bottom of these crevices, and they would see these foaming rocks. They were Pumas, like foaming rocks, and they didn't like the way railroad workers smelled funny. You know, you ever smell a railroad worker, ooh, boy, those Pumas get very vicious. And, you know, stuff like that.
Dickie, this is still incredibly funny.
It's stupid stuff, yeah, but it is sort of fun.
It is.
It's fun. But the underlying, I think one of the gifts we got was Tommy's ability to pull that kind of stuff off. On paper, he could really, it doesn't look funny.
No.
We scripted an album. This is another thing. We did 11 live albums, and we didn't, only one we knew before we did it was our first one. And because that's, we worked a year and got the material and got a record contract with Mercury. Then they wanted more albums once we started doing TV. And we had to learn the album as we were doing it in a nightclub. So we would learn a song. You know, if you do any of this stuff, you know what I'm talking about. You learn a song barely, and then we would try to think of ad-lib funny things to do it. And then we'd edit, 4 days edit,
yeah,
with a razor blade, things that might sound funny,
right,
together. But then you have the laughs or not laughs in the background. It wasn't 8-track tape. It was like 4-track or less. And then we would learn, we get an album, and people like these albums. They're just patched together. Then we would learn the material off the album. And once we got that down and made it really funny, way better than the album, we couldn't record it again because
right,
we already did it.
Right.
We should have. In retrospect, it would have been cheap. Just bring it and put this the good stuff.
Right.
Then they said, we need another album. He says, oh, shit, we just learned the last one. So we would do a new one and do the same thing. We're so lazy. So Save Your Ass Comedy is the note of the Smothers Brothers. And that was Tommy's ability to always come up with something that would be funny. So and we didn't think it was exhausting or anything else.
No, it was fun.
Yeah, and I didn't edit it. I went out and partied, and Tommy would edit the stuff because he's the guy that was passionate and involved in all this stuff.
Okay, so wait, stop. So you guys are doing this stuff and doing this stuff and doing this stuff. And in the meanwhile, you've decided you're going to follow Uncle Dick and you're going to be a teacher and you go
yeah,
to college.
Yeah.
So then what happened?
So is that a cliffhanger or what? I never get to do that. I often have to interrupt interviews because they're too long and do them half in 1 week and half in another week, but I never get them to be quite this dramatic. So tune in next week to find out how little Dickie Smothers, on his way to being an elementary school teacher, becomes the guy everybody knows. And now I'm going to play that bit that he talks about in the interview about the Pumas. And, well, there's nothing more to say. Here are the Smothers Brothers.
Take it.
You're supposed to take it. Aren't you a folk singer?
Yes, but I said no because I didn't want to take
it. Wait a minute, you're a folk singer. Have you read the folk singer's guidebook?
Yeah, but I didn't want it.
And what does the guidebook say? says all folk singers are obligated to do what?
You're obligated to take it.
Without hesitation, without thinking, yeah. Like a reflex, Tommy. Take it, Tom. Boom, boom, boom.
Yeah,
when
right.
I say take it, hop to it.
Boil that cabbage down.
Take it, Tom.
Boom, boom, boom. Hundreds of years ago, the railroad started in America. Rugged men of yesteryear went out in the wilderness with vision in their eyes and big 9-pound hammers in their hands. Went out in the wilderness to build the great spider web of steel rails, the transcontinental railroad to span our country, as these men went out in the wilderness and toiled and inched their way across the vast bosom of America. Thought there was a little sex in the show. This wasn't just a fun job. There was dangers in this job as they built the railroads up the mountains and down the mountains and in across the deserts and over raging rivers, and they had to span crevices, deep crevices in the ground, and in the bottom of the crevices there was pumice. Just pumice with claws and foam coming out of these pumice mouths, and the railroad men, they're going, "Woo! Look at those pumice down there! Across the crevices, there's pumas in there."
There were no pumas in the crevices because we don't have pumas here. There are no pumas in America.
Well, maybe some came over to visit.
They don't visit. Now, if you want to keep your story truthful, you get rid of the pumas right now.
I'm not going down that crevice. There was these vicious beasts in these deep crevices, and these rare men said, "Well, look at those vicious beasts in the crevices. They look like pumas." But they weren't. And they were sore afraid, yet the railroads were completed. Yet the transcontinental railroads were completed, and a big feast was transpired for these rugged railroad men. And the sole substance for this big feast for these railroad men, the sole substance was hotcakes boiled in cabbage juice. Not so popular now. Go ahead and sing about something else.
Self-advised to go, I learned to ride it well.
Crashed into a telephone pole and broke it all in pieces.
Down Lowerston, that old cake brown, the only song I ever did sing, pull that cabbage down. Oh, working on the railroad, working all day long.
Take it. Have you ever read the folk singer's manual? It says when someone right, says to take it, you're supposed
you're
to
right,
take it.
Right.
I said to take it, and you didn't take it.
I'm sorry. I'm very sorry. Really, I'm sorry.
Well, don't get belligerent.
I'm
you didn't
not.
Take it.
I said I'm sorry. That's all I can say. I'm sorry.
Well, that's okay, then. Don't make any more mistakes. Working, 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 working.
Pour that cabbage down, boy. Pour that cabbage, pull that cabbage down, boy. Turn that old cake round. Only song I ever did sing. Boil that cabbage down.
I don't know about you, but I've heard this thing a number of times now, and it continues to be funny to me. And it's even funnier when you see it. So I'm struggling with my website. I don't know how to do it, and the people are supposed to be doing it or not doing everything that I want. But I want very much to put this up on my website because it's funnier when you see it. But if I can't put it up on my website, go to YouTube and just, you know, punch in YouTube Smothers Brothers and this will come up and watch it because it's worth watching. Or you can just go to my website and hopefully the podcast of this will be up there, and you can listen to it again, which is what I will do. Anyway, that, of course, is the one and only Smothers Brothers, and there really was only one of them. And next week, in the second part of the interview, Dickie will talk about that, how they invented this thing that they did inadvertently without realizing that they were inventing anything. And, of course, it is that they were so different than anything else that made them so incredibly popular and so quickly successful. It's a wonderful, wonderful story. So hopefully you'll hear it next week. And now, as always, I want to thank Josh Hackney, who is my IT guy, and who is entirely responsible for your hearing that piece of history from the Smothers Brothers show. Josh manages to take things off of YouTube and then email them to me so that I can put them in my computer and put them in the show. I don't know how to do that, and he does. I say every week that I couldn't do this without him. I really could not. It's not only that he has this expertise, the expertise to do these things which I do not, but he's kindness personified. He never tells me that I'm dumb when I have to ask three or four times how to do the same thing. And he comes here and fixes the sound so that it is as good as my equipment can make it. So if you have questions or lack of expertise or confusion, or you need to learn something about recording, about the computer, about the web, about electronics, and you want a kind and knowledgeable person, it's Josh Hackney. And you can reach him by going up on my website. And the other things you can do on my website are, you can listen to the old shows, this one hopefully too, and you can learn about my book and my CD, and you can order them if you like. Lots of things to do on my website, but one of the things you can do on my website is click on Contact Me and say, I need to talk to Josh, and I will put you in touch with him. So the website is The Lynn Show, that's thelynneshow, thelynneshow.com. And of course, you can click on Contact Me and talk to me as well. Anyway, I hope, as always, that you heard something in the show that you can use, something that entertained you or tickled you or amused you. Anyway, something that will bring you back. I promise you that next week there'll be more about brain chemistry and more Dickie Smothers. So I'll be here then, and I sure hope you will be too. Tune in again next week when I'll be explaining how we can change brain chemistry and playing the second half of my interview with the delightful Dickie Smothers.
My hair is turning gray, always in my face and figure I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go. From the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister